So, good morning. I'll call the meeting to order. This meeting will be held in accordance with House Rule 10.01, which is posted online. Mr. Smith, would you conduct the roll call, please?
Chair Sundin is present. Vice Chair Vang?
Present.
Vang present. Anderson?
Anderson present.
Anderson present. Burke? Present. Present. Eklund?
Present.
Eklund present. Hansen R?
Hansen R present.
Hansen R present. Hansen J?
Hansen J present.
Hansen J present. Cleavorn?
Cleavorn present.
Cleavorn present. Lippert?
Lippert present.
Lippert present. Lewick?
Lewick present.
Lewick present. Miller?
Present.
Miller present. Nelson?
Present.
Nelson present. Thompson?
Thompson present.
All right. We do have a quorum, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. We have the minutes of the previous meeting. Vice Chair Vang, what's your preference on this?
I move the adoption of the minutes for the meeting of February 10th, 2021.
Okay. You heard the motion. Are there any questions or corrections? Excellent work again. All in favor of approving those minutes, say aye.
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 Okay, all those opposed, say nay. Okay, we have minutes approved. Thank you. Today is the last day of the budget program review for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. We also have two bills related to the briefing that we'll receive. All the meeting materials were provided ahead of the meeting and posted on the committee website. Deputy Commissioner Vobel will start the presentation, then we'll hear from some of the programs that have received pass-through funding. Welcome, Deputy Commissioner. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Sundin. Thank you so much for having us. I think, Nancy, did you want to share the PowerPoint, or did you want me to do that? Oh, okay. All right. There we go. Answer the question. Thanks, Nancy. So today I'm just going to give you a really quick overview of the agency's administration and financial assistance accounts. I know we've got a lot of really fantastic people to hear from, so I will go through these pretty quickly, but this should round out the accounts for the agency in terms of our spending activities. Next slide. So this is just a really quick snapshot of the administration and financial assistance programs we have at the department. 49% of that is dedicated funds, or $14.76 million. That is made up of indirects, our emergency response, our corporate farm fees, as well as our RFA, our Rural Finance Authority application fees. And then we have $15.1 million, or 50% of that is from general fund. And then we have a 1% from the federal fund. It's a $300,000 grant from USDA APHIS that comes from federal funding. Next slide. I thought I'd break down kind of how the what's funded through the agency. So the commissioner's office, as you know, the commissioner, Tom Peterson, is appointed by the governor. And then he appointed the deputy commissioner, the two assistant commissioners, and the director of government affairs. The commissioner's office also houses our legal services. That's where our general counsel is, as well as our data practices manager. He also does employment law and a number of other things. It also houses our Office of Emergency Preparedness and Response, our Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, and then our communications team is also housed at the commissioner's office. Next slide. So our communications team, it's made up of six folks, three public information officers. They are in charge of all things media relations, press releases, social media, our website, legislative communications, and then our internal communications, which we've really tried to drive up lately. We've done a lot of work on our website the last couple of years, and you'll see the top five pages that are visited in 2020. It's no surprise that our COVID-19 response pages were the top visited in 2020. We've also done a lot of work on driving up our Twitter and Facebook and YouTube presence. And then we do plenty of press releases. Hopefully you're all on our list and get all of them, but we do over 100 per year. So we keep them very, very busy. Next slide is Human resources. So I think, you know, obviously COVID-19, there was a lot that went into the response for the agency. There was quite a bit that went into the administration of the pandemic, at least in the Department of Agriculture. So our human resources really stepped up. They had to oversee our continuity of operations planning for the agency. There was a new COVID-19 leave policy that we had to administer and figure out how we were going to implement that and also train our managers and supervisors on it. We implemented a web-based health screening tool for folks that did have to come into the office. We worked with the Enterprise Redeployment Center on all of their redeployment of the NDA employees that had agreed to redeploy and help the Department of Health and others on the response. We did an employee status tracking tool, and then we also created an internal electronic process for the statewide hiring freeze. So we knew who was trying to hire, if they needed an exemption, what that would look like and what it was needed and how it was funded. The Human Resources Division also implemented an electronic personal transaction request system, which has streamlined a lot of processes that have made us more efficient, implemented a new affirmative action plan, and then they're also working to implement electronic document management system. Next slide. Office of Diversity, Equity, Inclusion is led by our Assistant Commissioner Patrice Bailey, and we have a wonderful coordinator named Sabrina Young. She works to develop a diverse and inclusive work environment that provides direct support to reduce inequities and ensure equitable, respectful, quality opportunities for all employees. And she's also in charge of providing culturally specific events, activities, and resources to MDA employees. We also do have our Diversity, Equity, Inclusion Committee. That's an internal committee made up of representatives from all of our divisions. And they meet quite frequently to talk about how to meet the goals that they've outlined here, which is expand cultural awareness and knowledge within the MDA workforce, provide training to MDA staff on intercultural and interpersonal skills, and apply an equity lens to current MDA processes and policies to improve them. Next slide. We also have our wonderful finance and budget division who keep us operating. So they are in charge of our accounting operations. So they do all of our budget and financial analysis. They help us plan long term as agency leadership to know what we can and can't do for the next few years. They help us immensely during the budget process. So they help us prepare the spending plan. They load the budgets into the MMB system. They manage all of our appropriations and coordinate all the fiscal year closings and reconcile our agency expenditures. They also do a lot of coordinating of all the federal awards that we receive, which is around $23 million annually. They also provide all the training on all the purchasers that we have within the agency that do the buying and also implement the contracts and the grants. They're in charge of handling all the money that comes in. So as you know, we have a lot of dedicated fees that come into the agency each day. And so they're in charge of handling all of those and making sure they're deposited and administered correctly. And then our central services division, who have throughout COVID have been going in each and every day. They handle all of our incoming and outgoing mail packages and make sure that we can just generally operate as an agency. So we're really thankful for them. I will go quickly through this. You've already heard all about our Rural Finance Authority and our AgBNP loan program, which the AgBNP loan program, the governor does have a recommendation for an increase in that program. And then Rural Finance Authority, of course, you've heard about. That's also, both of those programs are housed in our Finance and Budget Division. We've also heard about our Minnesota Farm Advocates, which is a contracted service, and that is also housed in our Finance and Budget Division. Just as a reminder, there are 10 farm advocates located strategically around Minnesota, and we do have a recommendation for an additional $20,000 ongoing to add that 11th advocate. And just as a reminder, they do assist farmers with identifying and resolving financial issues, ensuring they know rights and options, helping them navigate mediations, and then direct them to services as needed. Next slide. Here's a snapshot of some of the things we do for pass-throughs, which you will hear from the wonderful AJ Dewar and Sarah Dornick. But the County and District Agricultural Societies and Associations aid to an annual appropriation of $474,000. And the eligibility requires having held a fair for each of the last 3 years, unless prevented from doing so, annual membership of 15 or more, and it's paid out to exhibitors for premiums awarded the last fair held. Next slide. And then we do have a pass-through grant of $250,000 annually for regional or local projects through the Minnesota Agricultural Education Leadership Council, or MEALC. And I will stop there because I'm sure Sarah will go through that, that we're also proud to be a partner with MEALC on that pass-through. And then we also have a $25,000 pass-through to the Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation for their FEAST program, which is an exhibition they put on to celebrate local foods and local restaurants. And we've partnered with them a number of years on this, and it does go through the Administration Financial Assistance Program accounts. And that's the show. So I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Yeah, thank you. Are there any questions for the testifier from the committee? Okay, thank you for your presentation. Next up, we have County and District Agricultural Societies. We have Mr. A.J. Durer. Take it away. A.J. Durer, please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andrew Durer, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Federation of County Fairs. The Federation of County Fairs is an association that represents the Minnesota's 87 county ag societies, and also each of the roughly 91 fairs. Do the quick math, there are a couple of counties that do have more than one fair, and it's usually based on counties with a large geographical footprint. Like St. Louis has a northern and a southern fair, but primarily it's one in each county. What is a county ag society? Minnesota state statute actually has a chapter dedicated solely to county ag societies and county fairs. It's chapter 38 of state statute, which is, of course, under the jurisdiction of this committee. And in that chapter of law, it says that it gives the authority to a county to create a county ag society, and then that county ag society shall hold an annual county fair and maintain the fairgrounds. And obviously much more extensive than that. I thought it was interesting in Commissioner Bobble's presentation that, you know, with the premium funds, it has the requirement for holding a fair for the last 3 years, unless there's a calamity or epidemic. And somebody thought, I went back and researched back in 1905 to put that in there. So, and of course that became relevant last summer, because we did not hold county fairs, of course, due to the COVID-19 pandemic. At least not in the traditional way. Some fairs did hold a virtual fair competition in order to fulfill what at least we believe is the most important purpose of the Ag Society, which is to hold those competitions for the community, whether they be livestock shows or 4-H competitions and things like that. So there were some virtual county fairs that were held, but a lot weren't able to do that for a variety of reasons, so they just weren't held. Kind of looking forward, of course, county fairs are held. There's a few in June, but mainly in July and August. Of course, the county fair system is to build up to the culmination of the state fair. And, you know, of course, like everybody, we're optimistic that we'll hopefully be able to hold fairs this year. Obviously, it's wait and see. I know that some of the fairs that do hold their fair in June are contacting with their vendors to see if they can possibly push it back to a later date, because and it goes without saying, the later in the year, the more likely it is that we may be able to hold a fair. And, you know, and not only do we need to be able to hold it, hold the fair by being allowed to, but also we need to have the public confidence in holding that fair so that people will show up, because I've been told by pretty much every county ag society, well, it's really a financial hit not to have a fair. It's even worse to hold a fair and not have anybody show up. So we're hopeful for this summer to get back on track. And that kind of gets into the primary ways that county ag societies are funded and are functioned. It's primarily through aid from the county. There are a handful that receive some municipal aid, but not many. Sales made, you know, whether they're admissions, parking, tickets to the grandstands, things like that. And then, of course, there are a couple of state funding revenue streams. One, of course, Commissioner Bobble mentioned earlier in the premium funding. Since I've been working with the county fairs, I've been to about 15 fairs now, and one of the great things about them is they're so unique in their size and their focus and things like that. And they range from the Steele County Fair down in Owatonna, which is I think undisputedly the biggest one in the state. It is something to see if you have time to make it down there, to much smaller fairs, but I haven't been to one yet that didn't have a great time at. And the size and the scope typically previously was really focused on the county involvement. And of course, there's, the centers of population as well, because there's more people to buy tickets and things like that. So it was great where the state came in with their county fair grants and the ag budget, because those grants are administered by the Department of Agriculture. And the Ag Society submits the grant to the department, and then of the grant applications that the department accepts that fulfill the statute requirements, that aid is then distributed equally amongst all of the qualified fairs. So that funding stream really benefits those smaller county fairs even more so than the larger ones. And I do believe that. The state providing that aid is the reason that we still have 87 counties with a county fair in Minnesota. Just very briefly, one example I'll bring up of what the funds are used for. Those aid grants are typically used for one of two things. One is to maintain the aid related infrastructure at the fairgrounds, the aid buildings, and things like that. And the other is for ag education. And I was at the Ramsey County Fair a couple of years ago, and they used their grant because, as you'd imagine, Ramsey County doesn't have, or before this grant, didn't have the livestock and the animal presence that a lot of the more agricultural areas county fairs had. Well, they used that grant to bring in animals and to bring in some ag educators from the St. Paul Public School System to teach the kids that were going through about agriculture and things like that. And I thought it was fantastic. There were more kids going through that ag tent that the Ramsey County Ag Society put on than there were at the carnival section of the fair. It was great to see. So just one example of many of the things that are used. And then, of course, as was mentioned, I won't go into it anymore. I know you had a couple of bills to get to, but the premium funds, that's really the lifeblood of the competition aspect of the county fairs that, of course, then leads into the state fair. And those premium funds are also based on a formula so that they're distributed fairly equally amongst the state because there's always more demand. Other than last year, because we didn't have fairs, there's always more demand than there are funds. So then those funds are proportionally distributed out to each of the fairs. On a formula that's in Chapter 38 of law. I'll stop there in case there are any questions, but otherwise I really appreciate the time, Mr. Chair, and I look forward to talking to you more in the future.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Durr. That's terrific. Are there any comments or questions regarding Mr. Durr's testimony? Okay, hearing none, we can move on to Minnesota Agriculture Education Leadership Council. We have Sarah Dornick, Executive Director. Please take it away, identify yourself, and take it away.
Thank you. Chair Sundin, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Dornick, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Agriculture Education Leadership Council, or MALSE. MALSE is a 16-member legislative council that was started to promote and expand agricultural education opportunities across the state. We do have membership by statute, and there are six legislators on our board, including two, well, there will be three, Representative Lippert and a yet-to-be-named minority party member from the Ag Committee, and then Representative Thompson from the Education Committee. And then we have three senators, and then, of course, the other Ag Education representatives. Our staff is quite small. It's just myself and Carrie Schwab, our program coordinator, and we are housed at the University of Minnesota on the St. Paul campus, and we serve as our fiscal agent. Just a brief scope of our work. I could go into a long piece of the other things we do besides our funding, but we are guided by what we call as our 20 by 25 Minnesota AFNR, Ag, Food, and Natural Resource Education Blueprint. There is 92 goals in this blueprint that we are working to achieve in the five sectors of ag education that you see listed there. Again, I don't necessarily have time to go into each of the goals, but if you are interested, our blueprint is available online, and I can also send you a hard copy if you wish. For this committee, the funding pieces that I wanted to address, in this committee specifically, there's two pieces. As Deputy Commissioner Vabel mentioned, that we have this piece, which is our pass-through for the grants and scholar grants program, which is the $250,000. We also have the $2 million that is also passed through, and it's a portion of a GREET funding for the Farm Business Management and Mentor programs. And I'll go into a little more detail into those programs shortly. Just a visual breakdown of our budget for your reference. 8% of our budget is utilized for administrative costs. Otherwise, the 92% of our funding goes back out across the state through our grants and our scholarship programs. So we try to run a tight ship and make a lot of impact across the state. One area we really work hard on is our having enough quality educators in our classrooms. We continue to have a teacher shortage in agriculture as well as all of education. I will say we have increased the number of graduates coming out of our licensure programs. However, we still cannot keep up with the demand of programs that are starting. So, for example, we've had nearly 20% increase of ag teaching positions in the last 5 years, and I've maybe added four graduates in that position. So we're at 291 teachers, secondary, I should reference secondary, grades 7, 12. But we're doing our best to try to keep up with the demand that is out there in the state for AFNR education. MALC does serve as our State Teach Ag Results STAR Committee Chair. This is a group that's working on recruitment and retention strategies in our state for ag educators. MALC specifically coordinates, we have a Teach Ag Ambassador program, we have an internship, summer internship program, and we do a lot of things around recognition and celebration, trying to work on that retention area. So those are things we specifically work with. On our undergraduates, we've had a long time undergraduate program for our scholarships since I think about 2000. Our graduate program started in 2012, and then in 2016, we started a diversity fellowship at the time. This year, we looked at that, and we wanted to expand it and try to do a better job utilizing that as a recruitment to increase our diverse teacher pool. And so we opened it up. We now call this a scholarship, and it's open for undergraduate, transfer, graduate students, really, really expanding that access point to get into there. And we also have secured a donor that has committed for 5 years to help match whatever MALC puts in. So we're excited for that program to all of these programs to secure agriculture teachers. Program grants, another piece the specifically mentioned, we have two programs that we utilize. We call one common fund, which are statewide projects. The other one are strategic initiative grants. Our grants focus on increasing access, improving the current programs we have, and providing for teacher professional development. We have found our dollars specifically are helpful for those programs that are new and beginning. So for example, this past school year, we added 10 new AFNR programs in different school districts across the state. One thing about that's nice about these dollars that we're able to do is to give those dollars before they're officially have program approval. So there are some federal dollars and some other Department of Ed grants that they can't get right away, whereas we can utilize our dollars to help them pilot and get off the ground to get to that point. So we appreciate that. And then we just want to say that many of our, you know, we do have final reports on all of these, and I could go into a long report about that, but many of the reports say without these MALC dollars, they would not be able to implement their projects. So thank you to the legislature for that investment. Just a quick recipients, people always wonder where our grants go. This is the grants awarded in the past 5 years. So really pretty spread out. I will say most of our growth actually is in the northern part, so I'm gonna be expecting more grants coming from that area soon. But most of our grants go out into those secondary local programs, post-secondary, we call them support organizations, so like Minnesota FFA, Ag Teachers Association, Ag in the Classroom, and then the Ag Literacy grants. Unfortunately for our grants, we're only able to award about 50% of the actual asks that we get in. So that's a piece that we are always hoping to stretch our dollars and try to impact as many people. The last program that I needed to mention was our Farm Business Management and Mentor Program. So in 2015, there's another appropriation that was came through the Department of Ag to MALSEE. And there, the language says it's for ag education with a priority for farm business management. And so with this program, quick reference, farm business management is in our 8 of our Minnesota state colleges, and there are 67 instructors across the state that teach students who are farmers. So they could be adult students, they're not necessarily high school students. The challenge grant, it's a biennium challenge grant. We require them to meet 5 of the 8 parameters set forth at the beginning of the parameter. These parameters relate around stabilizing the number of instructors and the number of students, providing professional development and mentorship for instructors, and engaging in communities, so like community engagement, we're having them do demographic studies, and also increasing their instructor technology usage. We utilize these dollars to help push FBM forward. We also are using it to expand access with those two extra programs, the additional instructor grants and the instructor transition project. And then there's that little piece on the bottom there. We have mentor programs. So these are programs that we utilize for our teachers. And we believe they really help with the retention of teachers in our programs. And so we have programs, 2 at the secondary level, 1 at post-secondary, and 1 for farm business management. And then that last piece for evaluation. So with that, my remaining slides are just for your reference that are in your packet of kind of the status update. And I'm definitely willing to answer those questions, but I want to make sure I'm respectful of the time. And I thank the committee for the chance to just give a brief presentation on MALSEE, and I'm willing to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Sarah Dernick. I do have a question regarding your teacher shortage. What are the main obstacles? Is it just purely financial or recruitment of teachers? What are the obstacles?
Yeah, I would say there's a few obstacles. The first is just the general bigger picture of people wanting to go into education. So we kind of fight that bigger picture battle of kind of the image and some of the issues in education. They don't make enough money. There's a lot of administrative paperwork. I just want to teach. I don't want to teach to the test. So some of those bigger picture things. And then, of course, we're the specific little sector of all the teaching options. So trying to get them to the students that are interested in teaching to say, hey, have you thought about being an ag teacher? And then just trying to keep them through the pipeline, which is part of that committee that we work really hard on, which we do have some success this last year. We had 16 student teachers and 14 took positions this fall. So we had an 88% retention rate from those who graduated who entered the field. So that's very good. But that is one place. We lose them to ag business. They can make a lot more money. There's more flexibility, there's more maybe advancement that, you know, and then as an 18-year-old student has just been in high school and just says, do I really want to be a teacher? So we're also looking at trying to find people who maybe have entered the world and said, come back, think about being a teacher. You've gotten this experience now. So we're kind of hitting it at a multi-pronged level. So doing our best.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? I see one hand up at this point. Representative Anderson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Dornick, thank you for your presentation. I have some concern about the $2 million for the FBM program, Farm Business Management. That money really kind of got the program back up and going again, got a couple of new instructors. And my question is, was that a one-time appropriation or is that now in base funding?
That is in base
funding. Ms. Dornick?
Oh, sorry, Chair Sundin, Representative Anderson. Yes, that is in base funding now.
That's good to hear. Thank you.
Representative Lewick, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question, going back to teacher qualifications. I know one of the issues that occasionally seems to crop up is teacher with extensive qualifications. A lot of people don't realize if you're going to teach ag, in our K-12, that is one of the toughest, most extensive qualifications you can acquire. But occasionally we see where the school district then takes that individual, and because they're qualified to do almost anything, science, math, on and on and on, they get bent over into areas that don't focus on ag. Is that a big problem, or is that just a occasional happens? It sure can chase them out if they don't want to, if they want to stay in a particular area. Anyway,
Chair Dunnick, please. Chair Dunnick.
Chair Sundin, Representative Lewick, kind of two pieces of your question that part of, one piece with the licensure piece and people that are really highly qualified in the technical skills. We do have about 25 teachers in what we call tier one or tier two. So they maybe either have bachelor's, they either have a teaching degree, but maybe not an egg, or they have the technical skills, but not the education degree. So we do have about 25 there, and we are working a group trying to work. The University of Minnesota Twin Cities is one place that can do the graduate work that needs for that initial licensure. We're also going to be partnering with Minnesota State to try to get them their content areas at Minn State with their education pieces at the University of Minnesota and try to work them through as a cohort. That's a new up and coming project that is just getting started, because we've kind of recognized that how do we get these teachers kind of through that tier system so they get to be tier three, at least teachers. That's kind of one piece. The other piece, you are correct. We do have teachers that are spreading, I think particularly in rural areas, as teacher, you know, as budgets are tight, I think that's obvious. And then also some of the things our ag teachers can do. So we have a more flexible license that maybe some of the other teacher areas have. And so trying to what works best for the school and the teacher and what they need. But yes, sometimes it does happen. I would say we do have a few teachers that end up teaching maybe things that they don't want to be teaching.
Any follow-up on that?
No, thank you. That, but that does, you know, that can be a real tough situation. I know we've seen that where ultimately a teacher may have left and went to another school because there was the opportunity to stay focused in ag as opposed to into an area that, while they're fully capable of teaching, it wasn't their interest. I know as I think back, and of course I'm dating myself, but our ag program in the high school I went to was 3 years, and we did everything that everybody else did. We did the science, we did the biology, we did the metal, we did the, you name it, the math, over a 3 year program. In fact, it made things like geometry a little easier over in the math class because we already were exposed to it in agriculture. So anyway, well, keep up the good work. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Any other questions for the testifier? Okay, hearing none, we move on to Rick Juliason, Executive Director of the Minnesota Horticulture Society.
Hello. Thank you all for welcoming me today. I'm really honored to be here and excited to celebrate a partnership that's actually older than my native country of Canada. We were founded in 1886 by an act of legislature at the state fair. And the story goes that it was a bunch of rugged pioneers who were told, yeah, Minnesota's a nice place to visit, but you can't grow apples there. So they wanted to come together and support each other to learn how to grow in this northern climate. And that's a tradition we've carried on. So our first state funding way back when was to launch the Horticulturalist magazine. And now 154 years later, it is the longest continuously running magazine in the state. It's now called Northern Gardener. And we are still present at the state fair every year, including last year when we managed to have our plant show move online, and we have Adopt the Gardens there as well. So we have been a recipient of your funding for many years. For this current year, it's $17,000. And it is important for you to understand the impact that your investment in us is having, especially during this time of pandemic. So our mission is cultivating a healthy, diverse, and sustainable community of Northern gardeners. That speaks a lot to our values and our focus. We have 9,000 members. Our magazine goes to 12,000 people statewide and beyond. Our website gets 30,000 visits a month. And we truly are beyond just this state, but primarily in Minnesota. Our programs, our Garden in a Box program, helps provide materials and education for schools and underserved communities and people in food deserts, now known as food apartheid, to learn gardening skills and have the opportunity to grow food for themselves. 35% of the participants are in northern Minnesota, 28% in southern, and 37% in Twin Cities. So it's very spread out. And 46% of the participants identify as from the BIPOC community. Our second program is Minnesota Green, where we work with nurseries and professionals to reclaim plants that otherwise would go into the landfill or compost. And we redistribute those to nonprofits, to housing projects, to giving gardens, to schools, community gardens. So we keep them in circulation and provide important plant materials. On the education side, I've already mentioned Northern Gardener magazine. We also have an e-news that goes out monthly to 10,000 people. We have a lot of webinars and workshops. Our website, as I said, is well trafficked. And fourth, we work in partnership. As a statewide organization, we see ourselves as a convener, as a place of connecting different partners. We run classes and projects in partnership with the Arboretum, with Master Gardeners at the U, groups like that. Minnesota Green, we have 97 partners, and you know I wanted to say 100. We just attended a really good workshop on racism and diversity in agriculture, and now we would like to convene all of the Minnesota partners who are at that or interested to talk about, as a society of agricultural educators and supporters, what can we do? And we are launching a resource hub, which is an online platform where we'll be listing all the classes and events being put on by us and our partners. We'll have articles and resources available there. We've developed maps so you can find a community garden or a nonprofit partner or a food shelf or resources in your area. And that's something we're really aggressively growing this year. And I would mention we're doing all this with only 6 staff. So we are a very lean organization. And the main point I want to make is just how important this work is this particular year during the pandemic. We are directly addressing food security, for example. Our Garden in a Box program served 5,000 individuals last year. 2,300 of those were children, and 45,000 people since 2008. Last year, they grew 3,377 pounds of food just in that one program. Minnesota Green tripled last year. We gave away over 55,000 plants to over 6,000 gardeners. We were supporting giving gardens, churches and groups and individuals who wanted to deliberately grow excess food and get those to families through food shelf partners. And through that program, we helped 75,000 pounds of food reach families in need. And that was in partnership with groups like the Open Door Pantry or the Sheridan Story. We also address health. It is very well documented the importance that growing has on physical and mental health, and that's been so crucial during this time. And like, just like that, at a time when people are feeling isolated, we provided safe opportunities for people to get out to their community garden, to attend a webinar, to grow together in a safe way and keep that sense of connection that we need so badly. Our work in the environment with soil health, water health, CO2 emission reduction. This year, we're launching a very aggressive campaign around pollinator-friendly gardens and native grasses and seed saving. And finally, just there's been a hunger for education. Our workshops, of course, have all gone online, and attendance increased last year from 1,200 people to 3,200 people, almost triple the number of people wanting to get education about gardening. I was one of them. And when the pandemic hit, the first thing I did was go to the garage and bring in a door and set it up as a table in my dining room and start seedlings and plants. I wanted to feed my family. And we're providing that opportunity for people to learn how to feed themselves and their family and their community. So thank you so much. It's my understanding that we are not currently included for the first time in decades, if not centuries, in the state budget. And I would just like to emphasize that I fully understand that Governor Waltz has difficult decisions to make and that funds need to be directed towards core programs. And I hope I've made it clear that our program is core. It is directly addressing the needs out there right now. This isn't the time for us to reduce our activity. Our plan is to continue growing to serve more of the community need. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Juliason. I really enjoy hearing from testifiers that have passion for what they do for the state of Minnesota, and you're absolutely one of them. So thank you so much for your testimony. Are there any questions for Mr. Juliason? Okay, thank you very much. I guess not. So we can move on to Allison O'Toole, Chief Executive Officer of the Second Harvest Heartland Farm to Food Shelf Program.
Great.
Allison O'Toole, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Good afternoon. On this cold afternoon, I'm Allison O'Toole, the very proud CEO of Second Harvest Heartland, and I'm very happy to be with you. I'm here today to discuss, as part of the Department of Agriculture's budget presentation, the Farm to Food Shelf program, which has provided millions of pounds of needed produce, milk, and protein to hungry Minnesotans since 2015. Historically, Farm to Food Shelf has covered two categories of food, produce and milk. Both are essential to keeping the state fed and running. The produce grant allows farmers to donate produce that would otherwise go unharvested or unsold. And it's a clear win-win as they support the hunger fight while this funding from the legislature covers their costs to harvest, pack, and move unneeded crops. At Second Harvest Heartland, we oversee the produce portion of this program on behalf of Minnesota's six Feeding America food banks. The scale of our operations at Second Harvest make this relationship a good fit, as we can manage the outreach and finances of this work while ensuring statewide reach. While Farm to Food Shelf participants work across the state, most are focused within the Second Harvest Heartland service area, which covers central and southwestern Minnesota, and that of Channel One Food Bank in southeastern Minnesota. A member of our team at Second Harvest Heartland, our sourcing team, works with farmers to coordinate produce donations, and our finance team manages the invoices and reimburse costs farmers incur in harvesting and transporting the produce. The current funding base provides the network, on average, about 7 million pounds of Minnesota-grown produce each year. From July 2019 to June 2020, we sourced 6 million pounds of produce. And so far in this second grant year, which runs from July 2020 through June 2021, we've sourced 4 million pounds of produce out of an expected 6 million pounds. Over the program's history, we've sourced more than 37 million pounds of produce, made up of 25 different varieties of fruits and vegetables from 120 different growers across our state. This produce reaches people living in all 87 Minnesota counties. Minnesota's Feeding America food banks receive additional funds through the Department of Agriculture to purchase milk each year from Minnesota processors. That's the milk grant I mentioned maybe a minute ago. And our sourcing team conducts a low-cost bid process to choose our dairy processor as outlined in the bill language. Currently, at Second Harvest Heartland, we source our milk from Prairie Farms, which is based in Woodbury. And each food bank works with the processor in their own region of the state. At the current funding level, the state's Feeding America food banks use Farm to Food Shelf funding to source 280,000 gallons of fluid milk annually, which is just over half our needed milk for the year. In just the last 5 years, we've provided over 1 million gallons of fluid milk to families in need across our state. In April 2020, when COVID began, we received an additional infusion of Farm to Food Shelf funding that was intended to purchase low-cost protein and additional milk from Minnesota producers. It was a just-in-time delivery of support for this vital program and enabled food banks to ramp up our protein sourcing at a time when the need was at historic levels. That need continues. We are on track to source 400,000 pounds of protein and 260,000 gallons of milk with this additional support. Thank you for that support late in the session last year, I guess. So I just want to say thank you for your time and your support. Thank you to the Department of Agriculture for your partnership in this work. Milk, produce, and lean protein are among the most requested items at food shelves, and they are consistently very challenging to source. Farm to food shelf funding makes it possible for us and our food bank partners to fill more fridges with these staples that power our state. Thank you, and I'm happy. I know, Mr. Chair, I am with you again in a couple minutes talking about the bill, so I'm happy to take questions now and in another few minutes.
Thank you very much, Allison O'Toole. I really appreciate the work you do for the state of Minnesota and the people that receive some of the bounty that you help provide. So are there any questions for the testifier from the committee at this point? Okay, hearing none, we'll move on to the bills. The first bill, House File 790, follows this presentation from Second Harvest Heartland. Representative Jess Hansen, please, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Sundin and committee members. I move that HF 790 be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus ag finance bill. This is a bill to continue to provide funding to Second Harvest Heartland, who we just heard from and is a key partner in our battle against food insecurity here in Minnesota. I'm passionate about this bill for a lot of reasons, but I'll share one with you today. I'm passionate about this because I grew up hungry. My parents worked hard and were responsible people, but we didn't always know where our food was going to come from. I was the kid with the cheese sandwich at the corner table in elementary school, and I often had that big red dollar sign stamp on my hand that alerted everyone around me that I was from a family experiencing food insecurity. This left a mark on me, and so when I decided to run for office, I knew that I wanted to do my part to stand up for and with Minnesotans who are facing hunger in one of the richest nations in the world. Some people may not know this, but today we're in the fight of our lives against the war on hunger. 1 in 9 adults and 1 in 6 kids are experiencing food insecurity here in Minnesota. Second Harvest Heartland is a leading team of experts, as you just heard, and they're helping to make sure that our neighbors are less hungry by getting produce, protein, and milk products into Minnesotans' hands. Families struggling to make ends meet are facing unprecedented and uncertainty in the face of COVID. And families of color are experiencing food insecurity nearly twice as much as their white counterparts. Minnesota's public-private partnership with Second Harvest Heartland is bridging one of the many gaps in the war on hunger and inequity. This bill seeks to increase the farm-to-food shelf funding from the current $1.7 million to $2.95 million and includes making the new protein program and milk program you heard about permanent. This funding adds to their other portfolio of funding, and appropriating money to Second Harvest Heartland has historically been a very bipartisan effort, and I thank everybody for that. I'm looking forward to continuing this valued public-private partnership with Second Harvest Heartland. And at this point, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Allison O'Toole, the CEO of Second Harvest, and she'll tell you more about the needs and where this money will go.
Allison O'Toole, would you please identify yourself once again and continue?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Allison O'Toole, the CEO of Second Harvest Heartland. I will share my screen. We have a short presentation. So thank you, Representative Hansen, for sponsoring this legislation, this critical legislation. Second Harvest Heartland is the nation's second largest food bank, and we are here in support of House File 790 to increase funding for our Farm to Food Shelf program. I'll begin by defining our work. Simply put, food banks move food from where there is more than enough to where there's need. in the heartland where there's plenty of food to go around. Food banks like ours tackle the complex logistics of sourcing and storing millions of pounds of food each year and transporting that food out to nearly 1,000 food shelves and other community partners across our state. So you can think of us as sort of like a wholesaler. Oh, let's see here. Sorry about that. Last year, we distributed 120 million pounds of food, adding up to more than 105 million meals. We are so grateful to all of you for the additional Farm to Food Shelf funding provided last year, which allowed us to meet the many hunger-related challenges that COVID-19 has introduced. Those challenges continue. In 2020, getting food to people safely was an around-the-clock effort, requiring us to reinvent our service model again and again. We're honored to do so in partnership with our state's other Feeding America food banks. Our scale and efficiency make us a critical player, keeping food moving when times get tough. And they have been really tough. A decade of progress in the fight against hunger was undone by COVID nearly overnight. Today, 1 in 9 Minnesotans, including 1 in 6 Minnesota kids, is food insecure. We've distributed 30% more food in the last year, and our food shelf partners have reported a 60% increase in visitors since COVID began. Here we are. Families of color have been especially hard hit, experiencing at least twice the rates of hunger as their white counterparts. The family on the screen right now is the Crawfords, who have braved layoffs, COVID diagnoses, and then hunger, like so many other families in our community. They turn to their local food shelf to receive produce, protein, and dairy, made possible by programs such as Farm to Food Shelf. They're in a better place now than they were just a few months back, with their health recovered and both Aaron and Sheila working part-time. But they've not fully bounced back financially yet, and they tell us it will be a long process of rebuilding their stability over time. They're not alone. While we may be on our way in terms of broad economic recovery, our partners at McKinsey and Company project that we'll continue to live with high levels of hunger like the ones we're seeing right now for years to come. Additional funding for Farm to Food Shelf will provide needed help to families like the Crawfords and critical support to our state's farmers, milk and protein producers who have always been strong partners in the fight against hunger. Community food shelves are winners too. Farm to Food Shelf supplies 1/3 of the fresh produce that we at Second Harvest Heartland source from farms each year and over half of the milk, easing the near constant pressure on the Hunger Relief Network to provide these staples in our community. The food is fresh, stays local, and nourishes the community in every sense of the word. At Second Harvest Heartland, our partners we faced down an unprecedented need last spring. The legislature responded with an additional $1.25 million in one-time funding for Farm to Food Shelf. The funding was used to help increase our milk supply and, just added last year, low-cost protein. We are incredibly grateful for this support and the positive impact that it had on our work and the people we help serve. The funding categories covered by Farm to Food Shelf, produce, milk, and protein, are the most in-demand items at food shelves. The support to purchase more of this product and to source it locally helps us provide familiar foods that growing numbers of families cannot afford on their own. Of the $1.25 million $1.25 million in one-time funding received last year, $625,000 will be spent to secure 400,000 additional pounds of protein for the state, with all Feeding America food banks receiving a portion of that product. $600,000 of that funding has been spent on an additional 260,000 gallons of milk, which will just about cover the complete demand for milk through this funding year. Continuing this funding into the next biennium will enable food banks to retain these gains in the most needed food categories at a time when hunger remains at an all-time high. At the end of the day, this will allow us to keep farmers, families, and communities healthy, seeing us through to better times. We know this hunger crisis will take a lot of smart collaboration to tackle, and no one organization can do it on their own. Hunger will not be solved with a vaccine, and the light at the end of the tunnel is still very far away for far too many of our neighbors. We're prepared to source the needed food to meet this increased need for as long as it takes. We stand by this community and this state. Our hope is that the state will continue their investment in the fight against hunger by continuing the additional financial support for Farm to Food Shelf through the next 2 years. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. I am happy to take questions if there are any.
Thank you very much, Allison O'Toole. Are there any questions, comments to the testifier? Well, this is an easy group today. Thank you so much. With that, Representative Hansen and Ms. O'Toole, House File 790 is laid over. Okay. Vice Chair Vang, would you assume the chair while I present?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Chair Sending, please move your bill and feel free to begin.
Okay, I move that House File 178 be recommended to be referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay.
Just a brief over.
Yes, please go ahead, okay. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. 178 secures additional funding for the Farm Advocate Services. It captures $60,000 of CARES money. And the bill actually requires reporting to the chairs and ranking members of the hiring process of any new advocates for the program. And this is retroactive to December 20. So that, in a nutshell, is the bill. And as I referred to, we're capturing CARES money. There's $60,000 available, and I think we could put it to use. And if Sarah Darnick would like to chime in on any of this, I'd welcome any comments from her.
Sorry, I stepped away from my desk. What was the question?
What's the capital of South Dakota?
Oh, what?
All right. I was just explaining House File 178 and how it captures $60,000 for the CARES funding. And I was just wondering if you had any comments on House File 178.
I do not.
Okay, well, thank you. With that, any questions about 178? Excuse me, that's the chair's role.
I don't see any hands up.
That's all I've got. It is that simple. Thank you. Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is more of a general question for the chairman. You mentioned, Chair Sundin, that you're capturing some CARES money for your bill. And going back to House File 790, where they got over $1 million last year in CARES funding, is there any opportunities to pick up additional CARES money on a bill such as House 790?
I couldn't say for certain, Madam Chair, I couldn't say for certain on that. We could talk to the department and see if anybody is present that could weigh in on that.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Does the department have any comments?
Yes, Madam Chair, my name is Peter Chesnut. I'm the Director of Government Affairs from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Just simply, we're not sure yet exactly if there's going to be more of an opportunity to get additional CARES funding for the Farm Advocate Program. We certainly thank Chair Sundin for bringing this bill forward. We definitely support the addition of adding one more farmer advocate to our team of 10. We would like to try and ensure that we have continued funding for that new person, which is one of the reasons why we have the 20,000 per year in the governor's recs. But we are committed to working on this with the chair and the committee and all interested parties.
Representative Anderson, follow up?
I didn't really get an answer to that. Evidently, they're going to try to see if additional funding is coming, but is there any money left over from last spring's allocation in the Department of Ag?
Peter?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I apologize. I misunderstood the question. There is no funding left over from last year's CARES dollars that were available for the Farm Advocate Program.
Follow up, Representative Anderson.
Okay, thank you. That answers my question, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any further questions or discussion? Chair Sundin, do you have any closing comments before you renew your motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we should grab this money while we can before it goes away. That's it. I'm hoping for support for House File 178 from the committee.
Okay. Chair Sundin renews his motion that House File 178 be recommended to be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Mr. Smith, please take the roll.
Sundin.
Aye.
Sundin votes aye. Vang.
Aye.
Vang votes aye. Anderson.
Anderson votes aye.
Anderson votes aye. Burkle.
Aye.
Burkle aye. Votes aye. Eklund.
Aye.
Eklund votes aye. Hansen R.
Aye. Hansen R votes aye.
Hansen J.
J, aye.
Hansen J votes aye. Lippert.
Lippert votes aye.
Lippert votes aye. Lewick.
Lewick votes aye.
Lewick votes aye. Miller.
Votes aye.
Miller votes aye. Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson votes aye. Thompson. Thompson.
Aye. Thompson votes aye.
Thompson votes aye. That's 13 ayes and zero nays.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Cleaborne votes aye.
Oh, I must have missed you. Sorry. Cleaborne votes aye.
So on the vote of 14 ayes and zero nays, the motion prevails and the bill will move on to Ways and Means. Chair Sundin, any announcements before we adjourn? I think that's the last thing on our agenda.
Thank you, Chair Vang. I do have the governor's ag bill on the desk outside of my office, 417 in the SOB. If anybody wants to have a good look at it and sign on, that'd be terrific. I plan on depositing that into the hopper later this week.
Okay. Thank you, everyone, for your participation. On Wednesday, we will hear the Board of Animal Health Budget and Program Review, and then we will take up two bills. And we'll see you then. Seeing none, this meeting is adjourned.